Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thank you for coming back to the Playoff Gate podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Nick Osello. And Nick, it is Monday morning. We have had a good night's sleep to recover from the first round of the NCAA tournament, and we've got a lot of action to discuss. Take us, young Sherpa.
So, always exciting. Oh, playoff matchups, and what a disappointing weekend of lacrosse, because all we had was stress, high anxiety games, high octane games, incredible matchups, incredible storylines, winners, losers, laughs, tears. I laughed, I cried, two thumbs way up, the hit of the summer. So the way that we're putting together this here podcast and the structure is I really wanted to do the idea of worst to best and just start with, oh, wow, Virginia beat Richmond and Notre Dame beat Utah, a billion to zero apiece. But we're not going to do that. What we are going to do is subjectively just go through the most entertaining games, the best storylines. And to me, that starts with Army versus Maryland. Certainly the most social media buzz by a mile. And it had a little bit of everything even going into the game. Army, who's going to root against Army? The future soldiers of this country. Bunch of great kids. Their schedule, they're doing things that nobody else is doing. And meanwhile, on the other hand, you have Maryland, the undefeated national champions of yesteryear. There was Glovegate. There was a lot surrounding Tillman. And is he the villain of this year's college lacrosse season? So you had the Patriots, and then you had a little bit of what was slated as David versus Goliath, with everybody rooting for the hero David. And it was honestly, a big theme of games this weekend seemed a team jumping out to roughly a 7-2 lead and then chaos ensuing after that. So Army was the one that came out and just started throwing haymakers. They scored the first three, eventually ended up being 7-2, but then Maryland ended up tying it by scoring the next five. Brian Rootbell made only five saves, and while Army was able to get an empty net insurance goal, it was the last like 30-ish seconds that I thought made this one of the best games. Army gets the insurance goal. Maryland scores to make it a one-goal game. Weirman wins it forward and gets a good shot, but the shot goes high. Irksa gets a shot. Shot goes high. Chorus gets a shot, shot goes wide. So not only did they get that goal back so that it was a one-goal game, but the last couple shots, it was just so puckered, so, oh my God, what's going to happen? So playoff lacrosse.
Yeah, well, and to your point about the team jumping out to the lead, in the other three games that featured leads that were roughly equivalent, the team that was out to that early lead ended up losing. So that was my big takeaway for this. And I think you're right to point on those final hinge moments because, you know, one of the things that is certainly a storyline coming away from it is Maryland only got five saves. And my scrolling of Instagram comments or tweets or whatever was that my takeaway was that they didn't give enough credit to the Army shooters. I thought that the number of shots that Army shooters took with their shoulders square to the goal, their hands free, and just put their whole chest into it was remarkable. And I think that the commentary that pointed out that it felt like every Army offensive player wanted the ball in his stick, whereas it felt like there were a number of Maryland offensive players that were playing tentative, I thought was spot on. But all that being said, So you're Army, you're the underdog, you're playing against the defending national champions, and you lose a lead, right? So it goes from 7-2 to now the game was tied at, I believe, 7-7, 8-8, 9-9, 10-10. You fell behind 12-11, and then the game was tied again at 12-12, 13-13, and 14-14. So the really notable but kind of crazy coincidence of this game was that one of, I don't even know if he was credited with a save, but one of the shots that Brian Rubel got his stick on was under 2 minutes to go a shot that was going to miss the cage, go out of bounds. He got a stick onto it. So as a result, Army got a reset and was able to run the clock down even farther. So once Maryland eventually got the ball back down to, they call timeout and just run an incredible out of bounds play. Like the type of play that makes you wonder, how were they not able to do it all game? And the answer is because you only get two timeouts a half, but certainly something to be mindful of relative to the next time you play a Maryland team and how dangerous they are coming out of timeout situations. But the play of the game, and this is just me not showing up ready for the podcast because I don't know which Army defender it was, but the back check on that Braden Erksa shot that prevented it from being on target and made it sail a little bit high, that was the play of the game because Maryland had looks to tie, and they were quality looks that could have gone if it hadn't been for an excellent sellout, an excellent last-second Army play, and just a tremendous effort in terms of sense of the moment, really. Not being overwhelmed, not being overcome, not despairing, not losing hope and faith, and the ability to bounce back. One of the huge storylines for this game, and it's a big storyline for Maryland's season for sure, is injuries, right? So, when you reflect on Maryland's entire season, you take yourself back to the fall and keep in mind that they lost Eric Maliver, who was, meant to be the quarterback of this offense. And then in their second game, they lost to the goalie, Logan McNaney. And then in the regular season game against Johns Hopkins, they lost Ajax Zapatello, who, at times last year was the best defenseman in the country. Army lost two of their top six starters before the season on offense as well, and also dealt with significant injuries over the course of the game, over the course of the season. Not the least of which, I shouldn't say not the least of which, because in the regular season meeting against Loyola on March 25th, it looked like their goalie Knox Dent had suffered a season-ending ACL tear. It turned out that it was an ACL injury. It just wasn't season-ending. He missed two games. He came back, and he made 16 saves in this. I mean, it's incredible that we've been talking about this game for almost 7 minutes, and we haven't mentioned Knox Dent's name. I mean, he was remarkable. He was the difference. But this was also an
Colorado
Army team that was playing
boy, too. How about it?
There you go. Sunshine State, gorgeous. He was also, I mean, they were playing without Paul Johnson and Bailey O'Connor, who are, again, two of their top six, minus the two midfielders that they lost in the fall. So, I mean, just the resilience of the Army team is, it's almost impossible to overstate. So, tremendous job out of the Black Knights. I don't know where their ceiling is right now. I'm not going to make any predictions right now. I'm going to let the week unfold a little bit, but oh my goodness, I would not want to be playing this team next weekend or the following potentially.
I let you get away with it because I didn't want to derail your train of thought, but you said that the Army shooters didn't get enough credit, and I think Nazi Germany would like to disagree with that because I think the Army shooters have historically been fantastic.
Move on from that point, I just want to call out the fact that we ended last week's podcast soliciting people to DM me for a ridiculous joke that you had made in poor taste. And candidly, it wasn't much better than that. So everybody who didn't DM me, just imagine that was the joke that Nick made.
Yeah, that was actually a way better version of my joke from last week, which is going to die alongside us, hopefully. And I feel like it's a very interesting point that you just made as far as what are every team's ceiling. And even further than that, if you told the team would accomplish X at the beginning of the season, would you classify this as a good season? Would you accept it as a success? More in the context of Michigan and Penn State, which we'll talk about later, but particularly with Army, you tell me at the beginning of the season, they beat Maryland in the first round of the playoffs, and I think that's a pretty successful season for Army. And I think that this is the one team that, while they would classify this, even if this was the end of the run for them and they lose the next game, it would be a successful season. But from that floor to how high their ceiling is, I think that gap is the biggest. Because I don't think Michigan and Cornell are primed to make a run like Army is. And I think that Army is, I mean, is it a dark horse? Is it, America's team? There are many, many
overplayed
tropes. Well, you could argue Navy and Air Force.
Okay, but they're not playing anymore this season. So certainly for the
America's
rest of...
team of the tournament.
Correct, correct.
But
yeah,
you
can
also argue Notre Dame.
So, as we are wont to do, you gravitate toward storylines. I gravitate a little bit more toward the tactics. And, you know, I just want to kind of revert to the idea of the fact that they were able to put up 16 goals on Maryland without two starters on offense, and what exactly it means, specifically because Reese Burick has, all season for me, been the most interesting number one attackman for a variety of reasons. A, he's replacing Brendan Nickdern, who was a Torton finalist and one of the most important players to any individual program that we have seen, and he went on to be the Rookie of the Year in the PLL. So you've got this guy who doesn't have the traditional skill set of a quarterback attackman. And, you know, I watched a bunch of their early season games trying to figure out exactly how it was. You know, he didn't operate as like kind of a two-handed behind the cage type guy. He was much more, you know, shading to one side, behind, like kind of below GLE, but not directly at X. And then in addition to that, one of the things that just was so persistent was how dangerous they were when they could get him switched onto a short stick. But it was just like, you know, I really felt like this Army offense is more than pretty much any other, and maybe the most among top 25 teams, characterized by an umbrella set of 8 to 12 yard shots. And they come from all over the place. These guys have quick releases. It seems like they all shoot high to high. A lot of sidearm releases. But like I said, I mean, and just watching this Maryland game, it kept coming back to me. The way in which these shooters... they were so vertical in their posture, and they had their shoulders square to the goal. It was so fundamentally sound. And, you know, the broadcast and Quint specifically made a lot out of what Evan Plunkett has done for this team this season. And anybody that saw Evan Plunkett on the recruiting circuit, it's not a huge shock. You know, maybe the extent to which he's been this awesome is a little bit of a shock. But he was an awesome recruit. There's just no kind of – there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Finn McCullough is the guy who came out of nowhere. Nobody could have expected the contribution that he gave. And what it allowed for was the combination of distributed pressure, which is what we have seen Army thrive on, not just this year, but for a really long time, even when they were and even when they are very singularly focused. Because this is a team that, dating back, you know, to Jeremy Boltis and Gareth Thule and others, have kind of had a guy. You know what I mean? They're a team where offensively, up through Nickdern, they have had a guy. But at the same time, like, when you look at their box scores, when you look in their wins, you know, it's routinely six guys with two goals. And I think that's what you see in this game. I mean, there are 13 players that produced a point. 12 players scored a goal. Burick and Plunkett combined for just two. Gunnar Fellows had three. Jacob Morin had two. Ryan Spizito had two. Dawson Clark, who's a freshman who I loved on the recruiting circuit, came in and scored a big late goal. Andrew Kelly, who's a senior, who was another player that I loved on the recruiting circuit 6-7 years ago, came in and scored a big goal. You know, there are seven players who scored on their only shot. Six players had one goal on one shot. I mean, just a
That's tremendous. That's a ridiculous stat.
Yes, just a tremendous all-around performance. And, you know, it's funny because for as much as I believe you don't want to play a team with this type of mojo and a team that is this well-distributed and is this hard to scout and hard to prepare for, it could go the other way, right? A lot about catching lightning in a bottle is that if you're this dependent on a lot of people, you're overexposed to one or two guys having a bad day, and then the domino or cascading effect that can have. And so I'm a little bit concerned about that, but despite that concern, I'm more bullish on what they're capable of doing. Just, I mean, you're right to start here, a tremendous performance. And, you know, I just kind of want to say another version of what I said with respect to Brian Ruppel not being the reason that Maryland lost this game. Maryland played pretty well. I mean, obviously they can be very disappointed by giving up 16 goals, and certainly I'm not saying that Brian Ruppel played well. I mean, you know, there is a scenario in which he saves 50%, and this was a 14-11 Maryland win. That is a possible outcome. But I for Maryland fans who are going to be disappointed, this is the second first-round loss in the John Tillman era. That's understandable. You know, this was a really young team that, as we discussed, was very injury-riddled. And, you know, this level of inconsistency or this being prone to being upset was always going to be available. And then the last point I want to make on this game before moving on is just around the idea of did Maryland deserve Army? And how was the bracket seeded relative to the way that it was supposed to have been seeded? And obviously, you know, Maryland being 7 miles farther away from Smithfield, Rhode Island than it needed to be in order for College Park to host Bryant. Like, yes, that is true. Like, the committee chair said that on our podcast last week, that they couldn't send Bryant to Maryland. They couldn't send him to Penn State because of the geography. And so as a result, they fell down to Johns Hopkins, who was the number 60. You know, but that being said, if that's the case, I mean, would they have been better off getting Princeton? I mean, based on what we saw against the Nittany Lions on Sunday night, another game that we're going to get to, I'm not sure that that would have been a better outcome. So, you know, I think what it comes down to is this is a pretty good Maryland team. It wasn't a great Maryland team. And when you're not great, you are susceptible to losing games like this. And, you know, they were great last year, historically so. I thought that they were going to be moderately better coming into this year. You know, they had some headwinds, they had some bad luck, and they had some injuries. And, you know, here they are out in the first round.
Yeah. Final 2 points that I'll make. One, Maryland fans, you can call Wine 1-1 and the Wambulance can come over and pick you up and take you to the hospital.
I don't know if I've ever heard Wine 1-1 before. That.
Oh, yeah. Wine 1-1 to call the Wambulance. And then the second was just another point about Army's, their ability to distribute pressure. I mean, I feel like that started in 1939 with Normandy, Midway, Okinawa, Guadalcanal, things like that. Another classic World War II joke from me. So
I could literally hear you typing while I was talking, because, and I know now that you were searching famous World War II battles.
I couldn't remember Midway. I didn't want to say other instances of war. I was like, what's a safe, offensive? You can say Normandy. And I was like, it's something. It's in the Pacific. I remember it being a turning point. Midway.
Incredible
so
movie.
Always study up on your hoodie.
Shockingly good movie.
Underrated.
Highly recommended. I'm sorry?
Underrated. People always go to the classics and they don't bring that one up.
So. I'm talking about the one that came out in 2017. Like, totally, pun not intended, flew under the radar. That.
Okay, go off, King.
All right, let's move on.
Okay, wow, that snuck up on me. That was really funny, Terry. Good job. All right, so the next game from stop laughing.
You didn't realize the old your own pun that you said.
Which one did I not realize?
It really snuck up on me.
Oh. Okay.
Getting loose on a Monday morning, everybody.
Yeah, another cup of coffee. Woo! Yeah, I got not much sleep, so I'm in a wacky, goofy, silly mood. So next mood, next game. Let's get it back on track here. Is Penn State versus Princeton. And the Nittany Lions stay undefeated at home, barely scraping by this Princeton team 13-12. And again, we did superlatives last year. This Penn State glow up year over year has been unbelievable. Going 3-11 last year to now in the quarterfinals. Congrats to all the players. And I cannot stress this enough. This is going to be a big storyline from the weekend. The Ivy League went 0-3. So don't forget last year when they got 7 teams. This year, they're showing their true colors. Ivy League went 0-3. That'll be something we talk about later. But it was the exact same thing where, similar to Army, except it was Princeton that jumped out to a 7-1 lead. And you said that Army was the only team to jump out to the lead and win the game. So Princeton jumps out to a 7-1 lead. And next thing you know, Penn State goes on one of the most ridiculous defensive stands in insert World War II reference. So it really was a tale of two completely different games. Princeton jumps out to a lead. Penn State puts on the absolute clamps, and then it was electricity for the last from 12 to 9 until it was 13-12. So, I mean, the goalie Frakion made 16 saves during that 32-minute stretch, and Princeton only scored twice.
No. Hold on. I have to clean that up. He made 6 saves during the 32-minute stretch. He made 16 saves on the game. And let me just jump in here, and I'll let you get back to finishing the summary in a second. Yeah. That is such a huge part of this whole dynamic and this whole story. So that's where I want to start, but continue.
Well, no, because I was just going to say that was the best defensive stand of the entire weekend, and what the hell's going back with these wild back and forth, why can't teams coast to a victory?
Yeah, so this I wrote this game story, and the Inside Lacrosse Slack was pretty dialed in watching this one, so I got to give a lot of credit to noticing this to Dan Kaplan and Patrick McEwen. But the reason I wanted to call out that 6 save during 32-minute stretch is because they got 15 stops during that period of time. And the thing that changed was Penn State went from guarding Princeton straight up, where Colter McAsee looked like he was playing as if he was a Torton finalist snub, which he was, and he scored 4 unassisted goals in building that 7-1 lead. But so, first of all, Nick, how do you feel about zone defense?
If there's something that I could take and put it on a rocket ship and send it into the sun, I think one of the first things that I would put on that explosion rocket ship to the sun is zone defense.
Have you ever played zone defense? And if you have, as a short stick D midi, where on the field did you occupy?
We got to get somebody from the Outlaws on this, because we did something called Zebra, which was we would execute it in the last 10 minutes, or sorry, the last 10 seconds of the shot clock.
Yeah.
If the ball was behind the cage, like shot miss with less than 10 seconds left, we would call Zebra. Me and the other short stick D midi would be nearside pipes, just getting ready to play the attackman whichever way he went, while all the other defensemen tried to stop skip passes and whatnot. All we did was just let the ex-attackman get a head start on dodging either me or Noah Molnar or whoever the other short stick team midi was. I hated it. I hated every second of it. I was like, let's just play defense. So
that's basically the zone I conceived of when we were seniors in high school and we were up like 5-2 at halftime, and right before halftime against Worcester, they inverted twice and we just didn't know how to handle it, and they got easy goals off of it, and it totally changed the tenor of the game. All that being said, what's important about the way that Penn State played zone was they put one short stick on the crease and one short stick on the righty step down shooter up top. And so as a result, they had 2 poles on, or really 3 poles on the left side of the zone orientation. And what it meant was that Colter McAsee was essentially always trying to get space or get looks or get a shot off against a pole. And in an effort to try to, essentially account for that, they started moving him over, like all over the formation. And, I wouldn't say this, like in terms of, kind of my observation, but Dan and Patrick's point of view was that it really made him less dangerous relative to how he had been. Now, my main point would be he was less dangerous because if he beat his man off the dodge, there was another guy right behind him. Whereas when they were playing man on man, that wasn't the case. They either weren't prepared with a 2 slide, or he was basically dodging the 2 slide and still getting to the goal. But the reason I wanted to make sure that we distinguished between the 10 saves that happened, or I'm sorry, like, yeah, the 10 saves that happened before they switched to zone, and then after kind of that drought period where they only scored 2
notes. That's why you're doing this.
No, it's not true at all. The reason I want to make that distinction is because too often I think people think that zone defense is about goalies playing incredibly awesome out of their mind, Adam Gittleman 2011 style. And I'm not here to argue against that. All I'm saying is that in this instance, Frekian played well. He made six saves and he let in two goals during a 32-minute stretch. That's awesome. It's 75%. It's outrageous. But at the same time, it wasn't as if it was a completely goalie-led defensive performance. Like, they managed to get stops during this stretch of the game without just playing defense by goalie. And, you know, whether it was unforced errors or caused turnovers, no, Penn State only finished with five caused turnovers in this game. So it really wasn't them taking the ball away. It was kind of old school defense. Make them make the errors, let them try to throw, you know, tough passes that just go out of bounds. Or Penn State backed up a couple of shots too, which, you know, was a function of a lot of things, especially because, you know, for me, even compared to Yale getting out to their lead, or Delaware getting out to their lead, or Army getting out to their lead, I thought that Princeton's edge over Penn State early was energy. I was so impressed by how high-flying Princeton came out of the locker room, and I just didn't think that Penn State was going to be able to match that energy, which is another testament to the job that the zone did. It was funny because somebody texted me when Penn State switched to zone, and they're like, zone, quote, what you do when you can't guard. And I'm like, yeah, except it also just changes the complexion of the game. It changes the pace of the game. It changes the tenor. And I felt like that's what it did. And it was a gutsy call. You know, not that gutsy, because you can always obviously just go back to, you know, playing them straight up if that's what you want to do. But, you know, my guy Joe Bucci, former inside lacrosse intern in his first year as defensive coordinator at Penn State, made the call, and they deserve a lot of credit for it because it worked and it was pretty remarkable.
So you say that this was more effective because it changed the pace and tone and speed of the game and toned down Princeton's energy, and that's a useful scenario in which you should implement a zone defense?
Yes.
I say no, just play better defense.
Oh, I thought that we were going to get an incredible World War II analogy right there.
No, yeah, I'm not old enough to really be getting into World War II, but I feel like in the next couple years, I feel like it happens to all old guys.
I feel like, yeah, the best case scenario would have been something involving, like, American submarines, like, creating this perimeter in the mid-Atlantic against, like, German U-boats. So look into that, and maybe I can just hear you typing away for the next 15 minutes, and you can come back with a joke that's completely out of date.
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, what if I come up with it sooner and then cut you off? Would you rather have that? No, but
turnabout's fair play.
For me, this game was awesome because it was a step forward in Penn State's story that they're writing this season. I can't get over the fact that they were an absolute dumpster fire. It's a team that's generally speaking difficult to hate. Certainly not as hateable as an Ivy League or other Big Ten programs. So speaking of Big Ten programs that are difficult to hate.
Are you moving on to the next program, the next game? Because yes, let me real quick just say the name Ethan Long. He scored five goals, and it's probably about as egregious that we just talked as much about Penn State Princeton as we did, as it was how much we talked about Maryland Army before mentioning Knox Dent's name. But Ethan Long, basically TJ Malone was looking for him. And again, you know, credit to the commentators. I thought Paul Carcaterra and Chris Cotter did a nice job of pointing out how Penn State essentially flipped their offense. They put their attack up top and they were feeding down low to their middies. And today it was Ethan Long, or this weekend, I guess, it was Ethan Long who was the beneficiary, and he scored five goals. And, you know, they were distributed throughout the game. It wasn't exclusively during the comeback. So, you know, he was just a guy that showed up, and that's what you need in come tournament time.
At the end of this podcast, I'm going to ask you who the MVP of the weekend was.
Oof, so all right. Whether well, thank it's you for the
Long,
heads up.
I just want to get that wheel spinning. So moving on to another Big Ten beating the Ivy League. As a reminder, the Ivy League went 0-3. And if you're an Ivy League fan listening, that's not me pointing it out because I'm biased and I want to rub the Ivy League's face in the 7-bid team last year. That's just me stating facts. Michigan, the other Cinderella story. This is the only team that I'd say could compete with Army as far as if your team's out, who's the team that you just generally bandwagon for just to have someone to care about. Michigan beats Cornell in their first NCAA tournament win, 15-14. their first tournament win since the Big Bang. It's never happened. And it's been a good couple weeks to be a Michigan fan. So to tee up this Cornell game, not only did they beat Ohio State twice, not only did they win the Big Ten championship automatic qualifier, not only did they beat Maryland, but they just have this tangible, fun momentum. They're starting to believe in themselves. And I feel like since the end of the regular season and what the Big Ten tournament did for them was give them the belief that they can go out and beat a Cornell. And as light and as dumb as a sentence as that is, when you kind of beat the heck out of Maryland, good credit to me for not saying a swear word right there. When you do that, that just makes you believe that even though Cornell might have been the better team on paper, whatever you want to criterize it as, Michigan comes away with the victory, and it was Peter Thompson's heroics. He scored four goals, including the beautifully executed OT winner, which saw a double team at X off of a pick. Pass to the backside goal. Really, really well done. And again, if we go back to the beginning of the year and I tell you that Michigan not only wins the Big Ten tourney, but beats Cornell in the first round, beats Ohio State twice, beats Maryland, how much of that would you have believed?
I mean, none. I can't. It's impossible to overstate how impressive this is. And, you know, for everything that you just said, and it was all true, and it's all deserving of attention and credit. You know, when I look at the box score of this game, and you know, I don't want to overreact, right? Like, I watched this game. I was in transit home from the barn burner that was Johns Hopkins win over Bryant for the first like 3/8 of the game. But all that being said, when you look at this, I mean, one thing stands out: CJ Kirst, 2 goals on 10 shots, 1 assist. I mean, the job that Andrew Darby did and the job that Andrew Darby has done over the course of the last 6 weeks of the season and the job that the defense in general has done is insane. Now, yeah, I mean, they gave up 14 goals to Cornell. So I'm not saying that they won this game because of defense. But the other side of the coin is that, you know, Nick, if you're asking, like, if I had told you, would you have believed? I mean, if I had told you that they had gone, what did 18 for 34, like, that's pretty good, right? That's a good day facing off. It's not remarkable, and it's not as good as you could have reasonably expected Michigan to do against Cornell in that department. You know, this Michigan team was the number one team, or the number seven team. They had Justin Weifel was the number one player facing off. Nick Rowlett was actually the more successful in this faceoff game. And not only that, but also Cornell won the opening faceoff of overtime. And Jack Haskaden, who had scored a goal earlier in the game, took the shot in an effort to win the game. And Hunter Taylor, who, you know, was kind of the hero of the Penn State win in the Big Ten semifinals, and then played well in the Big Ten championship game, made the save, and Michigan cleared, and it set up the game winner. So, I mean, I don't want to, like, this is a tough game to analyze in the sense that, you know, it very much felt, relative to some of the other games, like a players making plays game. And I think that that is true at the defensive end as well. You know, I didn't come away, I mean, we just spent two games, you know, dissecting a combination of Penn State's defense and, you know, why I was so impressed by Army's shooters, which is a reflection of their offensive game plan. You know, I didn't come away from this with like a super good tactical sense for why Michigan played Kirst so well. And so, you know, I have to just, until I can dive into the film, give a lot of credit to the guy that was guarding him and say that, you know, what I had seen from the last 6 or 7 games of Michigan was so reflective of a team that was on a string, and that's kind of the, you know, best thing that you can hope for defensively. That's it, kind of from an overarching standpoint. A bunch of guys playing really well and playing together and doing their job and coming away with what was, you know, an incredible but also incredibly narrow win, right? You know, a combination of vibes. I will say I picked Yale, Cornell, and Penn State all for the same reason. the reason being I was picking the team that was coming off of a loss, and my thought process was going to have sharper focus this week in practice, you know, preparing for a team who was coming in flying high and feeling good about themselves and was way more likely to essentially, you know, feel like they accomplished what they needed to accomplish. And so, you know, credit to Georgetown and Michigan for overcoming that, and bad job by me on those picks. So, yeah.
Yeah, bad job by you. And what I love is seeing what storylines people are forcing, and also at the end of the game, kind of revisiting some things that we were talking about. Because I was curious. I was like, Michigan, you know, I think Georgetown's certainly the hottest team in the country, but you could argue that Michigan was on the hottest program streak ever. I mean, I think that's almost inarguable. And Cornell, I don't want to say they struggled towards the end of the season, but they certainly didn't cap it off the way that they wanted to. So Michigan taking a little bit more momentum, and Cornell not having that momentum, how much do you look into that? I don't quite know. Is there anything that you want to touch on? Because that was going to be kind of half of a segue between Georgetown and Yale.
No, let's keep it rolling.
So speaking of that exact same storyline, an Ivy League team that certainly didn't have the regular season. They had a little bit of momentum, of course, but I don't think that you could argue that Yale had a full head of steam going into the playoffs. And conversely, Georgetown was the hottest team in the country. They've won, I think that was their 11th game in a row after they beat Yale 19-17. I mean, this is, it's too many faceoffs. It's too many goals. Get off my lawn. Slow the game down. This was a game that maybe you try to put in a little zone defense to do something. Stop me if you've heard one. Stop the press. Ivy League team loses this weekend. And I'm going to just start by putting my hand up and saying, my bad. That one was on me, dog. Because I was a Dordovic hater. I was a Georgetown hater. I wrote them off after their first two, three games of the season. I said, someone asked Nick, how do you think of Georgetown? And I go, I think Georgetown stinks. I think they don't belong in the NCAA. I think they'd be a quality MCLA program, maybe. I was wrong. Dordovic's nasty. His ability to go right, his ability to go left is actually sick. And again, that storyline, which I feel like people forget, of him transferring out of Syracuse, much to the rabble of their alumni, going to Georgetown where there was a slow start, everybody writing him off, not just me, that was all of us. And now them having won 11 straight is a pretty incredible arc. And this game was a sentient hold me back, bro, as there were a lot of words exchanged, a lot of chip, chip, chooping. And again, it was Yale that went up 8-3. So going through the game right here, Yale was up 8-3. Then Georgetown led 12-9. Then Yale 15-13, with the final score being Georgetown 19-17. Sheesh. 92 shots, Terry. 92 shots. At what point has offense gone too far?
At no point. Literally at no point. Just feed me all of these games and more. Andy Shea has now been involved in three of the five highest scoring games in NCAA tournament history. It's just a style, right? Like, it's so funny because, you know, I was talking to a couple of people about Yale yesterday, and they were just like, I conceive of them as a defensive program. I can see, because, I get it to certain respects. So this is a program that I know very well and have known pretty well for 12 or 13 years. And
sick brag.
The watershed moment was the 2013 quarterfinal loss to Syracuse. I believe the final was 8-5 or 7-5. It was at Maryland. It was a rainy day. And the reason it was so important in the formation of the program is because, you know, so Andy takes over in 2004. They basically weren't good until 2010. And then from 2010 to 13, they were trying to transition from being a good program into a team that could do more than occasionally win the Ivy League. And then his main takeaway from that 2013 loss to Syracuse was, we need to be more athletic in the middle of the field. And so that summer, he went out and recruited, I'm going to get some of these wrong, but in doing this from memory, John Danagelis, Jack Tye, one of the Mackies, either Connor or Brendan, Jason Alessi, Tyler Warner, and Joey Sessa. I mean, that is a haul. And basically, the sole focus being emphasizing athletic midfielders. And I remember talking to him as those guys were going through the recruiting process, and they weren't like the best known names on our lists. And, you know, the team was winning, but those guys weren't on campus yet. And so the kind of evolution of the program, basically now, the way I would describe Yale's style is blitzkrieg. Like, keeping with obviously the theme for the entire podcast, which I didn't expect it to be so World War II oriented, but basically it's all pressure all the time. And as we've talked about it this year, the focus has been on what does that do for your defense? Essentially, are you hanging them out to dry because they have to play more possessions because they don't have as much time to rest when you have the ball as your opponents do when they have the ball, and, you know, all these cascading effects. But one of the things that it means is that when they are playing as well offensively as they did against Georgetown, the only way to counter it is to outscore them, because they are not going to stop. They're not going to let up. And you have to take advantages of the moments in which they go dry for a variety of reasons. And you saw it happen in the second quarter after they took that 8-3 lead. They basically wasted six or seven possessions in a row. And that, in my opinion, is when they lost the game. Now, is any Yale team capable of essentially protecting a lead for 35, 40 minutes, given the style that I just described? Honestly, I think it's an open question, because even dating back to 2018 and 19, the core distinctions were a combination of, in 2019, they had T.D. Yerlin, and in 2018, they were just better defensively. And I give Chris Keating, their interior defenseman, a lot of credit for that. And I think that they have struggled since his graduation to replace that role. But ultimately, there aren't that many teams that have the firepower to take advantage of it. And what was interesting to me is that Tucker Dordovic rightfully deserves a lot of credit for scoring six goals. But his contribution in the game was in the early part of the game. He wasn't there in winning time. He wasn't the reason that they won down the stretch. You know, Brian Minicus was the bridge from the early part of the game to the late part of the game. And there were a couple of contributions in that span of time, Aiden Carroll and Will Godin specifically, who were really important. But I thought that the guys who brought this game home for them were Jacob Kelly and Nicky Solomon. And you know what's really interesting about the idea of Georgetown choking in the first round last year to Delaware and winning this game in the first round? Brian Minicus, Nicky Solomon, Tucker Dordovic, and Jacob Kelly, and Danny Hinks in goal weren't on the team. So those guys don't have any of the baggage of that loss to Delaware. That's not like hanging around with them. This is, for all intents and purposes, a completely new and different team. And, you know, there's a lot baked into that point, right? But at the same time, you know, when I kind of circle back around and when I refocus on, you know, the issue at hand, Georgetown won this game because they put up 19 goals on Yale. And one of the things that, you know, kind of the last point that I want to make about the factors that led to Yale losing this game, James Riley, Georgetown's faceoff specialist, came into this game with an injured hamstring. It was questionable whether he was going to play. He injured it in the Big East Championship game against Denver. And he came out, I believe he won the first faceoff, violated on the second faceoff, and then they sent out Carson Milburn, the backup, for the third faceoff. And I thought his health was so dramatically impactful on the outcome of this game, because I couldn't get past what Georgetown looked like in the quarterfinals against Virginia in 2021 after he got injured early in that game, and basically the floodgates opened. And that was one of those, everything that could go wrong did for Georgetown. So I'm not over exaggerating that, but at the same time, one of the things that went wrong was James Riley's injury. And so when you kind of forecast that onto this game, you know, and specifically look at it in the context of the success that Nick Ramsey had had in a number of recent games, chiefly against Cornell, which was played at a similar pace to this one, and a similar goal total and a similar number of faceoffs to this one, I felt that that was going to be a compounding advantage for Yale as the game went on. And it wasn't. I thought Ramsey wore down in the fourth quarter. I thought he looked gassed. I thought Machado Rodriguez, who went 2-for-4 at the faceoff X, looked good enough that they could have utilized him more earlier in the game, and that it would have had the effect of, you know, essentially putting more pressure on Riley and trying to test his hamstring more as the game went on, such that when it became winning time in the fourth quarter, you could potentially not only stack goals by winning back-to-back, but also really bleed the clock. I mentioned, I don't know if this Yale team can control a lead for 35 minutes, but they can control a lead for 7 or 8 minutes as well or better than any other team in the country, because of if they are winning faceoffs and continuing to apply pressure, you don't have to worry about them taking their foot off the gas too soon. They don't go into a prevent defense, is essentially what I'm trying to say. So, you know, they're going to continue to score, and I felt like that was going to be their path to win the game after Georgetown came back and took the lead back from that early 8-3 advantage. And it didn't go that way. So credit to James Riley, credit to Georgetown for managing the game in a combination of ways, and certainly credit to Nikki Solomon and Jacob Kelly for their composure and their feel for the moment and making those plays down the stretch.
And apologies to both goalies. I mean, my goodness, just... tough day to be in cage, great day to be a lacrosse ball, great day to be GLE, tough day to be a goalie. So rounding out what I would say were the exciting games of the weekend, the final one, Duke Delaware. And in a bit of a surprising, I would say this would be the surprise of the weekend as far as goal outcome. I think you could argue that all the other games should have been close, one or two goal games, but Delaware giving Duke everything that they could handle, and Duke narrowly escaping with a 12-11 victory, which honestly to me is terrifying because now Duke got that bad lacrosse stretch out of their system. And the story of the game and going into the game before we dive into it further was Owen Grant versus Brendan O'Neill, Canada versus America, big versus big, talented versus talented. A matchup we're going to be seeing for, I mean, realistically, a long time. I think this was kind of a fun little... let's reflect on this game 15 years down the line. So, excellent job by Owen Grant. And Brendan O'Neill was held to 0 goals through 3.5 quarters. And the only goal Brendan O'Neill ended up scoring was off of a rebound where he actually had a pretty miraculous one-handed jump up in the air.
That was incredible. And play of the weekend, for sure.
I was like, dude, what are you doing? Like, how is that even legal or possible? Again, the story that was defined by Delaware was up 7-3 and the rumblings of Upset City were brewing. And Duke fought back. And to me, it just came down to Delaware's sloppy play allowing to get Duke their first lead of the game at 9-8. And while it was a back and forth affair from that point, it was Duke's ability to commit less mistakes and ultimately end up taking home a victory on their home turf.
So you say it's terrifying that Duke got that one bad stretch or one bad game out of their system. And I wonder, because I don't know that this was necessarily Duke playing bad. I think that this was more so anybody who's listened to this podcast over the course of the year knows that I like to start the analysis of a game by saying, why did X win, right? So a 12-11 game, like Delaware did not lose this game because they gave up 12 goals. Going in, you would have been satisfied with that. They did not lose this game because they scored 11 goals. Going in, you might have hoped for a little bit more, but with the expected disadvantage that you were going to have at the faceoff X and how you battled that and overcame that significantly relative to this game last year, you probably would have been okay with it. I mean, They just lost this game because it was a great lacrosse game that somebody had to lose. But my point is that if you're Duke, I'm not sure that there is another team in the country, including the other teams with the next other great best defensemen, such as Georgetown with Will Bowen, Maryland with Brett Makar, Cornell with Gavin Adler. Owen Grant is so uniquely well-suited to guard Brendan O'Neill because of his size. And it's not just, I mean, Will Bowen is probably measurably roughly the same size, but Owen Grant and the way that he plays with strength and power is different. And I guess my point is, when Duke can't rely on O'Neill the way that they have over the course of this season, is it easy for them to get beyond 10, 12, 13 goals? And what I saw was a game decided by Andrew McAdory taking it over and scoring a three-goal flourish to completely shift the game. And it can't be a surprise for a guy who was the number one recruit as a rising junior and senior and number two recruit to only Griffin Schutz heading into his freshman year to see him make plays and have a sequence like that. But you look at All-America voting and you look at some of the commentary about Duke over the course of the season, I don't think people expected this out of McAdory. And the role that he has filled for this team has been much more that of connector and quarterback. And he has slotted in as the third leading scorer behind Dyson Williams and Brennan O'Neill. And, you know, he's the third attackman. Garrett Lemon is getting a lot of attention as kind of the number one midfielder. And, you know, I don't want to call him an afterthought. He hasn't been the central focus. He hasn't been the star of the show. But he was on Sunday. And they don't win this game without him, essentially, is my takeaway and kind of what it comes down to. And it's not to say that he's the only player that they don't win this game without. Wilhelm in goal started poorly and finished strong. And he finished with 11 saves. And arguably, they don't win this game without him. But at the same point, at the other end of the field, Matt Kilcarry, 15 saves, right? Delaware's not in this game without a good Matt Kilcarry game. So, I mean, just an all-around awesome game. I was very impressed by Delaware's face-off advantage early. Roland Hockenberry has been their number one face-off guy all year. They clearly identified that Logan Premtage was going to have a better advantage against Jake Naso. He ended up winning just 9 for 23, which is a 39% day. Understood. Not lighting the world on fire. But relative to what expectations could have been, I thought that, you know, for... And I got this wrong. Trey Wilkes was a college faceoff guy. He's an assistant at Delaware. He's awesome guy. But Jake Hervada is an alum and is also on staff. And so Grant Ament very graciously corrected me on Twitter in terms of who was responsible for putting this game plan together. But for Logan Premtage to go out there and particularly battle early, I think Delaware won the first three and maybe like four of the first six or five of the first seven, something in that neighborhood, as they were building that 7-2 or 7-3 lead. It was a impressive showing. It allowed Delaware to get its feet underneath itself. And, you know, for a team that beat Georgetown in the first round last year, has had to play in the play-in game each of the last two seasons, you know, it's disappointing that they're not advancing, but because they deserved it on the basis of how well they played. But they play the number one seed. And sometimes you just have to play that much better when you're playing an opponent that is just that much better. And that is, you know, kind of my simple analysis for this one.
It's kind of I love watching Delaware play. I have to imagine that it's one of the all-time nightmares of a defensive coordinator is a first-round matchup against Delaware, because the uniqueness in which they play the sport, like watching Delaware's offense is, I don't even really have a comparison. I feel like it would be the first time watching like a spread offense in football. It's like the first time you kind of go to an NLL game, or maybe like the Chaos, I guess, would be a lacrosse example, because the stick skills and the amount of twisters and the ridiculous feeds and even the stupid goals where it's like it's a half twister bounce shot that goes perfectly into the corner. I just feel like Delaware in round one, no matter what, is appointment viewing until told otherwise, because the last two games they've had in the first round have been absolutely electric. And to your point, I think Owen Grant is, I mean, he's something special. His ability to leverage his size and physicality, but something that always stands out to me is, let's not forget, he's a greasy socialist Canadian. And his ability to leverage his stick skills to a defensive advantage. I think some of his viral offensive clips speak for itself. Yes, he can find the cutter. Yes, he can find the low man. He can shoot. He can do a lot of stuff. But his ability to just get in the hands and make whoever he's guarding a nightmare, to have that physicality and to have the stick skills to match, I'm going to be watching him for a long time to come. And he is going to be, you know, I would say like the next Garrett Eppel.
The next Garrett Eppel. Interesting. Hadn't thought about that. Doesn't strike me as wrong. Just feels wrong to compare a Canadian to an American. So,
yeah, Epps might not like that one. Be like, hey, come compare me to someone who's not American. I'll be like, all right, relax, dude. Next round on me, and we'll call it good. Anything else from Duke Delaware?
Bring it home, Nick.
The last, so we've ended the segment of talking about good games because the other three games were absolute blowouts. So we'll run through those real quick. Notre Dame over Utah, just pure domination. Like there was nothing that Utah did better than Notre Dame. Notre Dame started good, finished good, long pole goals, short stick goals, a little bit of chaos in the field. Virginia over Richmond, 17-8. That score speaks for itself. Virginia's really, really good. That was a big takeaway that I learned this past weekend. And then Hopkins over Bryant. And we'll start at least talking more than just cruising through it with this Hopkins over Bryant. Final score of 22-8. And you're like, oh, it must have been total domination. No, I mean, it was 3-3. Bryant was up 3-2. And it was the first kind of buzz of the weekend, I believe. Because this game was Saturday.
This was Sunday morning,
right?
No, it was Sunday morning. Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
So it was the breakfast game yesterday where it was like, ooh, is this going to be another crazy day of lacrosse? And then Hopkins was like, no. And we're going to ruin everyone's nice time with a stupid band playing a stupid song. Hopkins Bryant, anything to note as far as how that game started?
Yeah, I mean, so Hopkins' first offensive midfield was not on the field for a goal until they scored their seventh goal. Brooks English is a second-line midfielder who, you know how when Cornell was making its run to the national championship game last year, there were a lot of folks that were fixated on how small Billy Coyle and JJ Lombardi and Ryan Sheehan and Spencer Wertheim and all these other middies were. It felt like you were watching a Cornell team when you were watching Johns Hopkins yesterday, and it's just a reminder of the fact that Pete Milliman recruits small guys. Like, he just doesn't emphasize or value size when it comes to the offensive end of the field. Brooks English is like 5'5", 140 pounds or something like that. It's what he looks like, at least, when you're sitting in the press box. And he's been a huge dynamic kind of contributor spark plug for this offense for going on a month now, maybe a little bit longer than that even. And he had his first career hat trick in the first quarter, and he allowed them to keep pace. And then once Matt Naruski scored, I believe it was the opening faceoff of the second quarter, the floodgates opened. And that's basically what it came down to. So, you know, kind of a move on moment for the Blue Jays, and congratulations to Brad Ross for winning the America East and making it to the NCAA tournament in his first season as the head coach of the Bryant Bulldogs.
Anything Notre Dame, Utah, Richmond, Virginia?
Gotta talk Richmond, Virginia, just in terms of how funny it was when the rain started.
It just was a slip and slide. It just... what are we even doing? This is awesome.
It would, I mean, it made me wonder if every game should be played on a flooded field, because when the ball just doesn't roll and when the players shooting and passing, just the ball doesn't go where it's supposed to go physically, it's a completely different sport. I mean, it did, like, you know, the rain stopped and the field dried out a little bit and the game started to look like lacrosse again in the second half, but the second quarter after the lightning delay, because the lightning delay happened at the very end of the first quarter, and it hadn't rained before that. So, like, the lightning delay ends, and then, like, right as the teams are coming back out in the field, the deluge starts, and it was just so heavy. People were talking about, like, do you remember, or have you ever seen, or whatever. And I remember when, I believe it was Syracuse, Carolina, in a ACC championship game at Kennesaw State, that was similar to this in terms of just like the ball is not going to go out of bounds ever. So pretend like it's box lacrosse and the ball's just staying in. It was going to make for a result or a game or an outcome that was going to be impossible to analyze. So glad that it turned out normal. And I think from a standpoint of like spinning it forward, the most important thing was just Connor Schellenberger looks healthy again. What it means for his role, what it means for his ability to score goals and how important that's going to be to their identity going forward. We're going to find out, right, as they take on stiffer competition. But yeah, that was my takeaway from that game. That was it didn't look like a yeah, cross for a solid 15 minutes.
Yeah, it looked like the 2016 MLL Championship. I mean, I thought I was literally that, and then you put UNC Syracuse. I mean, what are we even doing here?
Same venue, like either the same year or like 1 or 2 years apart, because that was Kevin Wright. That was that game. Was the one where they couldn't finish the game on the field because it was flooded, and they went to like the back turf, and Kark like periscoped it because there was no camera set up on like whichever field they finished the game on. But yeah, I think that was the 2016 ACC championship, and then like legitimately 2.5 months later, you guys dealt with the exact same thing, and our boy Jeremy Sieverts hit one of the most dramatic twos I can recall to win an MLL championship.
Yeah, it reminds me of Battle in the Rain, a World War II reference that I just found when I was literally Googling rainiest battles World War II while you were talking. And I couldn't come up with anything other than Battle in the Rain. Wow, really dialed in. All right, to take this puppy home, who was the MVP of the weekend?
Oh, my God. Such a tough call. I want to default to the homer pick and just go with Mike Boehm, but it's got to be Peter Thompson, I think. I mean, Michigan boy to Michigan boy for the overtime game-winning goal, first NCAA tournament victory in program history. Yeah, Peter Thompson is the MVP of the weekend. I'm sure that there are other compelling arguments out there, but I would want to hear him because for me, it's kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah, mine would be either General Patton or or Pat Kavanaugh. No, I don't have one. You're the
General Pat Kavanaugh. That's a good nickname for him.
Yeah, yeah. The General Patton.
Corporal Kavanaugh. Chris Kavanaugh.
Yeah. So that is what a weekend of lacrosse. And then I guess final question. The most exciting matchups of next weekend. Who are you most excited to just sit down, crack a little Dr. Pepper, put your feet up, and enjoy some more lacrosse?
All right, so we got Duke, Michigan on Saturday at Albany, or in Albany, and then we've got Virginia, Georgetown. And then in Annapolis on Sunday, we've got Notre Dame, Johns Hopkins, and Penn State, Army. I don't believe that those orders were correct. I think I had them flipped in both cases. I mean, it's not only because of the Diggs Tape versus Nick Asello rivalry, but Notre Dame Johns Hopkins is the game that I am most interested in. I would say Duke Michigan would be second. Penn State Army would be third, and that's only because in Georgetown, Virginia, I'm a little nervous about a repeat of the 2021 quarterfinals. But if Georgetown shows up, then that jumps up to number two. But either way, I don't see it passing Notre Dame Hopkins.
Why do you think Notre Dame Hopkins is compelling?
Because
that's
everybody
gonna
other
be
than
an
me,
absolute blow.
Everybody other than me thinks Hopkins stinks, and I'm telling you, like, Brett Martin and Hunter Jaronski are going to be so hard to dodge, and they're going to make plays. And Alex Mazzone is going to he's going to cause like four turnovers on picking off passes in the passing lanes. And as long as Timmy Marcial is locked in, Hopkins is going to be able to get stops. And at the other end of the field, you know, I don't know how they're going to manufacture goals, because that's what they're going to have to do. They're not going to get easy goals against Notre Dame. But, you know, this just – it feels like a game that is going to be very, very tense. Very tense.
Yeah. I mean, Russell Melendez is just going to be walking down the field with his books, maybe his backpack, maybe his glasses, and Chris Fake is going to come up to him and knock his books out of his hand, throw his glasses in the ground. It's going to be – I mean, final score is going to be like 18-6. It's going to be a blowout.
Well, then what game are you most excited for, aside from Notre Dame Hopkins?
Honestly, I really think Duke Michigan is slated to be an all-timer. That's probably going to come back to bite me in the rear. But Penn State Army, every storyline I feel has the interesting, like, oh, well, who won was generally supposed to who win, and now it's just about this team beating the number. Like, it's just about, okay, Duke, Virginia, and Notre Dame need to be upset by whoever their opponents are. And this game is the one where it's like, oh, well, this is a true toss-up, and it's two programs looking to advance further. Like, I feel like that's the most unique game of the playoffs remaining, and therefore is going to give me the most interest.
Also, it gives you the opportunity to make the most World War II jokes and puns for next week's podcast. So you can definitely understand where you're coming from on that.
Army playing a team from Pennsylvania. I mean, the jokes are going to write themselves. I'm just going to be reading and researching World War II. History Channel is going to be on in the background when we're recording next time. So,
Nick, that is a great note to end on. Thank you, as always, for your time listening to the Tailgate Podcast. Playoff Gate next week, we'll be back with Quarter Gate, and then we'll be back with Final Gate. If you like what you heard, leave a rating and review. Don't DM me for what joke we edited out that Nick didn't say in this week's podcast. But I appreciate all of you who did last week. And Nick, we'll be back next week with more Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Yeah, I got a couple DMs. Hey, Terry didn't tell me what joke you said. And I'm like, I'm not going to tell you then. So, love you, Terry.
Love you more.